Ever since it won the Golden Lion at the 1961 Venice Film Festival, the French film Last Year at Marienbad by Alain René has inspired wildly divergent passions, often in the same person. The British critic Jeff Andrew declared it, quote, either some sort of masterpiece or meaningless twaddle, unquote. The movie is now out in a new two-disc version from Criterion with a restored high-definition digital transfer. Our critic at large, John Powers, says it's like a monument from an earlier era.
It's been almost half a century since America entered the short-lived glory days of the art film. Movies that not only tackled serious themes, but did so with a strikingly modernist insistence on style. Such films felt new and exciting back then. And though it now sounds unbelievable, audiences actually left the theater arguing about whether they'd seen something revelatory or something merely pretentious. No movie was more controversial than Alain René's 1961 Last Year at Marienbad, which became so notorious that I'd seen it parodied before I actually ever saw the film at my college film society. I still remember how stoked I was to be able to see it, and frankly, how bored and baffled I was when I did. Here was art cinema with a vengeance. The guy who introduced the film called it great, and I left the theater asking my girlfriend, "Can something be great if it's not any good?" Yet the funny thing about Last Year at Marienbad is that it stayed with me over the decades, far more than many movies I'd thought better at the time. Still, this was never enough to get me to watch it again, until a few days ago. That's when I checked out the new DVD version from Criterion, whose ravishing black-and-white widescreen transfer captures the beauty of Sacha Vierney's images in a way that few viewers have ever seen. The story, if you can call it that, takes place at a resort whose chateau is filled with grand rooms, endless corridors, and enough Rococo decor to have Liberace screaming for mercy. Surrounded by socialites who stand around like zombies, a toothsome Italian man named X, played by Giorgio Albertazzi, pursues a glamorous French woman named Y. That's riveting Delphine Seyrig, hair swooped tight across her forehead and clad in a series of spectacular gowns designed by Coco Chanel. Over and over, X tells her that they'd had an affair the previous year, perhaps in the Czech spa town of Marienbad, and that she'd agreed to leave M, a faintly Draculean figure who's either her husband or her lover. Over and over, Y resists X's entreaties, insisting, truthfully or not, that she doesn't even remember having met him. And that's pretty much it. As René's camera glides through the chateau and its spectacular grounds, X and Y play out versions of the same scene so many times that we soon grasp that all the usual guideposts of a movie have been deliberately erased. The script, by avant-garde novelist Alain Robbe-Grillet, refuses to tell us whether what we're seeing is taking place in the past, the present, or the future, or whether it actually took place at all. Fantasy and reality, past and present, have been telescoped into an eternal now. Over the years, there have been countless theories of what this all might mean. Is the movie a parable of an era haunted by nuclear war? Is it about the repressed memory of a rape? Or could it all be just an intellectual game? Me, I think René is making a connection between two different kinds of wooing. Just as X tries to win over the reluctant Y, the movie itself is trying to seduce us into entering its imaginary world, which, like all movie worlds, is outside time. Half a century later, the world René wants us to enter remains as unsettling as quicksand and far more timeless than, say, Breathless or La Dolce Vita. He himself saw the film as an experiment, an exercise in high style, and what's striking is that this hypnotic work feels far more radical, more avant-garde, than anything I saw at Cannes this year, much less anything that will actually open in our theaters. It now seems incredible that such a movie could have been released commercially, let alone become an international touchstone, one that would inspire a zillion fashion shoots and perfume commercials, influencing everything from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining to music videos by Blur. Does this mean I now like the movie? I can't honestly say that I do, but liking it seems almost beside the point. Last Year at Marienbad is one of those primal experiences that's somehow just there, like the Grand Canyon or the Acropolis, or maybe Las Vegas. However you feel about it, this is one movie you never forget, even if you can't remember much of anything that happens in it.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.
Commentator Andrei Kudrescu has been our vigilant observer of the world for more than 25 years. He's tried to reshape revolutions, parsed the media landscape, wrestled with scandals and triumphs. Now he's taking on a new challenge.
This summer, I'm going to learn how to nap. Some people have no problem napping. They have the gift. They can nap standing, sitting, or lying down. They can catnap anywhere. If they have a desk job, they can nap at work. Students sleep through years of lectures and labs. The gifted have no problem, but I need to learn. I don't have the gift because I'm from Europe. We were too nervous over there to nap. Every time you dozed off, a war started, or they came for you. Americans are better nappers than Europeans because they feel safer. And that's despite the color-coded threats they intone at airports or the cable news that howl like coyotes. Young people are practically immune to warnings because they live encased in music. Nothing short of evacuation by force will penetrate their sleepy sound bubble. Older people sometimes are equipped by nature with the one guaranteed defense from the constant state of emergency induced by merchandising, deafness. That leaves those of us who aren't deaf and have no gift of the nap to somehow navigate the world horribly awake. One inferior remedy is a sense of perspective. Worse things happened in the past. That's true, but they weren't so loud. In the past, you could sleep through any disaster as long as it wasn't happening under your feet or overhead. Other people's disasters were muted. You might argue that knowing about more horrors makes us more sympathetic, but hearing about it at cable news decibels has the opposite effect. It makes us less sympathetic to any disasters. They make you want to take a nap. Another substitute for napping is going into a retreat with silent monks. That's kind of like napping for a whole week or months. Short of that, nitrous oxide is pretty good for having a good nap-long giggle that shuts the world out. None of the substitutes qualify. I hear that the CIA can teach how to take a deep, short nap and wake up fresh enough to kill. I would like to take that course, minus the kill part. I have faith. The wind will teach me.
Poet, novelist, and would-be napper Andrei Kadrescu is the editor of Exquisite Corpse.
Around 20 years ago, Americans began shifting the way we think about our homes and the mortgages used to finance them. To take note of this change, we sent Planet Money's Hanna Jaffe-Walt on a mission.
This all started because my editor used to watch All in the Family as a kid.
Well, not just because of that.
And there he is, Steve Drummond, NPR's national editor. It was, right, because you remember watching Archie Bunker burn his mortgage.
That certainly is part of it. But I was also, throughout this crisis, I've been thinking about the idea of a 30-year mortgage and how crazy that seems to me now. I'll be 76 or so when I pay mine off, and I don't even really think about it as a real possibility. But people do pay off their mortgages, like you used to hear about people burning the mortgage.
Like Archie Bunker.
Exactly.
Burning the mortgage over here.
Archie, be careful. Don't set fire to the house. Remember Cousin Henry?
Yeah, I always hated him.
Anyway, so yeah, I thought it would be cool to meet someone like that. We keep hearing about tens of thousands of people losing their homes, and I wanted to hear from somebody who had actually paid off a 30-year mortgage. And Hanna, you said you were going to do a story.
Yeah, and I did start making calls. Right after we talked, I called a mortgage broker in Seattle named Jeff Tisdale. I'm in search of people who are towards the end of paying off a 30-year mortgage.
Good luck.
Why do you say good luck?
Oh, well, there's been multiple times over the last 15 years where interest rates have dipped down and people have refinanced. And typically what happens, for the most part, reset the clock.
So what, this one guy didn't know anyone?
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. I called lots and lots of other people, mortgage brokers, banks, community lending people, the whole shebang, Steve.
One time in the last 28 years, I have seen a title report.
Towards the end of a 30-year mortgage, you might be looking for an endangered species.
There's one couple that I know of that may have done that, but I'm not sure that they paid it off. Yeah, actually, they won the lotto.
No way, really?
Yeah.
Steve, that was Judy Holzer, Erica Malone, and Robin Finley, all veteran mortgage business people laughing at me.
So, Hanna, this is all just to tell me you didn't do the story?
No. Steve, come on. I got you.
Come in.
Hello.
Matt's not here yet.
Welcome to the home of Tamar and Chris Pearsall in Seattle. These two bought a home in 1978, paid it off 28 years later.
Hey, you found it.
Yeah, they were great. So Chris rides his motorcycle everywhere, and Tamar is in IT, and she's got this great laugh. They're one of those couples that's been together so long, they talk in this way, like their sentences are made up of parts from one of them and parts from the other.
It was just
a day-to-day thing.
A payment that we made every month.
Well, you know, I think there was a point when we started. It's not a never-never kind of thing. So
we could see and that was exciting, the idea that we wouldn't have to make that payment every month. We suddenly were kind of electrified by the notion that we could own this free and clear.
So here's the thing about this assignment, Steve, why I think the Pearsalls were so hard to find. So first of all, there are just fewer people like them. Just in the last 10 years, there's been a 7% decline in people who own their own homes free and clear of debt. But that still leaves us with a lot of people. Something like 30% of homeowners don't have any mortgage debt. But those people tend to be older than the Pearsalls, and just of a generation that was really uncomfortable with the idea of debt.
Yeah, but as interest rates went down, millions of people refinanced, and that wasn't necessarily bad. Lots of people saved, you know, a lot of money on their monthly payments.
True. It just didn't always used to be like that. Tamar basically says, look, we never refinanced. We just made the payments. And Chris says he thought about moving once or twice, but he'd look around at those houses for sale and the prices.
You know, for us, when they started talking houses in sub-increments of $1 million, we're going, huh? That's a lot of money.
An ordinary house for $500,000 or $700,000, it sounded outlandish.
Uh-oh, I don't want to know.
$35,000, Steve. The Pearsall's house, 1976, cost $35,000.
Ouch, that hurts my brain. Okay, so the real question here, was there a mortgage burning involved?
Sorry.
Well, I remember when we made the last payment, I was at work and I was on the phone with the mortgage company, and my coworkers were all going, oh, we've never known anyone who paid off their mortgage. They were all standing around. I'd always heard of people burning the mortgage, but there was nothing to burn.
I think we went out to dinner.
We went out to dinner. Yeah, that's what we did.
The Pearsall's son actually just became a homeowner, too. He got a home that was in foreclosure. And he says he will be there 30 years till he owns a place, at which point, Steve, he promises he will burn something. You happy?
Yes, very happy.
Okay. Chana Jaffe-Walt, NPR News, Seattle.
This is Tom Goldman in Portland, Oregon, a long way from France, but a place where there's a lot of interest in the tour. Portland consistently is near or at the top of the list of best U.S. cities for cycling, and everywhere you go, you see cyclists riding to work or pounding up hills during their lunch breaks, which is what Jim Kuhn is about to do. Hi, Jim.
How you doing, Tom?
Every July when you're doing these rides, are you imagining you're in the tour, like climbing the Pyrenees or the Alps, when you're really hunched over your bike, really going for it?
I think imagining the Pyrenees or the Alps would be a little intimidating, but there's an extra energy in our little peloton here in Portland when the tour is happening.
Jim Kuhn saw his first Tour de France when he was in France at the age of 16. Now a 60-year-old lawyer, Kuhn follows the race online, even the bad news. Kuhn is bothered by the doping scandals, but he doesn't dwell.
I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about who's going to make a brave attack off the front and get 15 minutes on the peloton, who's going to win a sprint. So that's just not an issue that I prefer to focus on. It's no fun. 12:15, gentlemen. Time to ride.
Jim Kuhn hops onto his $3,600 racing bike and heads out with about 20 others for a thigh-burning ride through the Portland hills. Unlike Kuhn, veteran cycling journalist Joe Lindsay will pay attention to the doping issue. It's part of his job covering the race in France this month for bicycling.com. It may be self-preservation, but amidst the steady drumbeat of bad news, Lindsay finds some silver lining.
I think last year's tour was an improvement. It was cleaner.
Despite several riders testing positive, Lindsay says the absence of lopsided victories on some of the 2008 tour stages was an indicator that fans were seeing an honest race.
They didn't have the raw strength to be able to just blast out of the field time and time again and respond to attacks and, you know, roll away from everybody like it was nothing. And you can look at things like that and say, okay, I believe we're making progress now.
Lindsay says at this tour, anti-doping officials are planning to test lots of riders, particularly star riders who are expected to do well.
The critics say I'm arrogant. A doper.
There's no rider with a bigger star than Lance Armstrong. He's marking his comeback tour de France with a feisty Nike ad that draws familiar battle lines between the good guys, cancer survivors like Armstrong, and the bad guys, his detractors.
They can say whatever they want. I'm not back on my bike for them.
But the biggest fight Armstrong could face in his quest for an eighth tour victory may come from his own teammate, Alberto Contador. Contador won the 2007 tour, and he's been designated the leader of the Astana team, meaning his teammates, Armstrong included, are expected to help him win. Joe Lindsay says an Armstrong-Contador competition could create a perilous situation for Astana.
If one of them gets the lead early, they may feel a little bit more pressure to defend it and therefore defend their status within the team and keep the guys working for them. If they do that, that runs the risk of really kind of using up a lot of the energy and the resources of the team early before it's needed.
And it'll be needed, says Lindsay, near the end of the tour, which features a monstrous mountain climb.
It may very well decide the race. And if you're tired before you get there, then you have no hope.
Which is the operative word for the Tour de France. Among the riders, hope for victory. Among the organizers, a desperate hope for a clean, okay, cleaner race. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
In this wretched economy, states around the country are struggling to balance their budgets. Ohio is among those that began a new fiscal year on the 1st of July with no budget in place. For the first time in 18 years, Ohio is operating on a 7-day interim budget. The state's Democratic Governor Ted Strickland joins us now from the State House in Columbus to talk about the budget impasse. Governor Strickland, welcome.
I'm happy to be with you.
And one idea you've had to help balance the budget, you've proposed legalizing slot machines at racetracks. That's something you have been ardently opposed to before. Why'd you change your mind?
Well, we're living in a very difficult time, unprecedented. We haven't had an economy like this for 70 or more years. And so I was faced with certain choices, either a further cutting vital programs, which I think we cannot do, raising taxes, which I think would be hugely unwise in this economy, or looking for additional revenue, and the additional revenue will come to us if we get approval for the video lottery terminals at our racetracks.
Well, you said if we get approval, and that's a pretty big if, I gather. There's been a huge legislative fight over this in Ohio, and the Republican president of the Senate says, look, if you want to have slots, do it through an executive order, put it to a statewide vote, but don't have it go through the legislature. And it seems that voters support him on that, according to the polls anyway. They want this to come up for a referendum.
Well, it can come up for a referendum, but the fact is that if we do that, it will do very little to help balance the budget. So I've said to the Senate president, if you want to have a referendum on slots, you can do that, but that will not balance our budget.
Governor Strickland, walk us through some of the numbers here that would explain why Ohio's finances are such a mess right now.
Well, Ohio is suffering from everything that every other state in this country is suffering from. We are in an international economic slowdown. In Ohio, we are having a particular problem, obviously, with the auto industry, which is a huge issue in our state, second only to Michigan in the building of cars and trucks, and perhaps even first in the production of auto parts. So we are experiencing the results of an economy that went into deep recession and for too many people, too many Ohioans, has turned into a personal depression.
What are some specific cuts you've had to make in services in your state?
Well, we've cut mental health services. We have cut funding for certain child care programs. We have reduced funding for our adult prison system. We have reduced funding for our youth services. I have negotiated a contract with our state employee unions where they are willing to accept no raises for the next 2 years, and they are willing to take 10 unpaid furlough days each year for the next 2 years. I have refused my own pay raises, and I am cutting my own pay. trying to be, you know, a participant in the sacrifices that I am asking of others.
Well, Governor Strickland, are you looking at other states who are in similar trouble and getting any ideas for ways out of this budget mess that you're in there in Ohio?
Oh, you know, I talk to my fellow governors frequently. You know, within the last month, I have talked with Governor Schwarzenegger, Governor Doyle of Wisconsin, Governor Granholm of Michigan, talked with Governor Rendell just a couple of days ago in Pennsylvania. I have great sympathy for my fellow governors, and we are talking. We had a discussion regarding our responsibilities and our authorities if it became necessary to actually have a shutting down of government in our states. Obviously, we all hope that that would never happen, but we're trying to be responsible and prepared for the worst-case scenario as we try to deal with these difficult matters.
Well, Governor Strickland, thanks very much for talking with us. And despite it all, I hope you enjoy your holiday weekend.
Well, and I hope you and all your listeners have a great 4th of July. We live in a great country, and we ought never to forget it.
Democrat Ted Strickland is the governor of Ohio.